This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's our Friday Week in Review, but it's really a mayor in review this week, the Boston mayor.
The yeas are 68, the nays are 29, and the nomination is confirmed.
For a kid who grew up on Town Street in Dorchester, from a family whose parents came to this country, immigrated to this country, being elected mayor of Boston was a dream for me. I am proud of what we've been able to do together over the last 7 years.
I, Kim Janey,
do solemnly swear
that I will support the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Madam Mayor.
Today is a new day. I stand before you as the first woman and the first Black mayor of Boston, the city that I love. I come to this day with life experience that is different from the men who came before me.
The United States Senate confirmed Dorchester-born Marty Walsh as the next U.S. Secretary of Labor, the first person with a union history to head the agency since the 1970s. And that, of course, paved the way here at home for a daughter of Roxbury to blow up tradition and become the first Boston mayor who isn't a white man, acting Mayor Kim Janey. So what's not in transition? The pandemic, or maybe it is, but transitioning in the wrong direction. And the Baker administration continues to face fire from a lot of directions on how they're handling it. Here's Dawn Carmen Seabor, executive director of the Mass Health Officers Association, at an oversight hearing this week.
The administration has spent hundreds of millions more taxpayer dollars to hire consultants and private organizations to run its clinics, while ignoring the plans and capabilities available from local health departments.
Join our panelists to talk about all of it, starting with how you're reacting to the ascendance of Mayor Kim Janey. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Joining us are Renee Graham, Boston Globe columnist and a WBUR contributor, and Ed Lyons, a Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Renee, Ed, welcome back.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Great to be back.
So let's jump right in with this historic moment, the swearing-in of Kim Janey as acting mayor of Boston on Tuesday. Renee, did you watch and how did you react?
You know, I watched and I was very emotional. You know, I've lived in this city for 33 years and I've always thought of myself as what I am. I'm a native New Yorker. But I felt an incredible amount of pride in a way that kind of surprised me, because there's something in seeing a moment that you never expected to see. And that's very much how I felt about a Black woman being sworn in as mayor in this city with this city's history. It was a pretty remarkable moment.
It's interesting you say that, because when I watched on Tuesday, it really brought me back. I was there when Ayanna Pressley was first sworn in as a member of the Boston City Council, you know, breaking all kinds of barriers with that, arguably laying the groundwork for today. And I just thought, okay, there's a straight line from yesterday, right? From that to this. I wonder, Ed, what's going to be different 5 or 10 years from now because of the threshold that Kim Janey broke this week?
I don't know. I've spent the past week just simply, you know, enjoying the joy and gratitude of the Black people and women that I know, and just really basking in how good they feel. I haven't really thought about it deeply in that way. I do think it was a wonderful scene to have Chief Justice Bud swearing him in. I thought that was wonderful optics for the city. I'm hoping that, you know, it does bring new voices and, more importantly, new solutions. There's a lot of justice to be done, you know, in Boston. And I'd like to see what she's going to do about that.
So listeners, how are you reacting to the swearing in of Kim Janey this week? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Renee, I heard you take a breath there like you were going to say something. So let me come back to you.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting because I think a lot of people are asking, you know, what does this mean? And I think it's important to start with what it doesn't mean. You know, it doesn't mean that Boston is post-racial. You know, it doesn't mean that the city's racial inequities evaporated when Mayor Janey took the oath of office. You know, it doesn't mean that the hard work of eradicating centuries of white supremacy and systemic racism is over, but it does indicate that there are the right steps being made in the right directions.
So to both of your point, Ed saying he wants to see what she's going to do, and you, Renee, talking about the steps she's taking, I want to play a little bit. We spoke with Kim Janey on Radio Boston yesterday. Here she is talking a little bit about her agenda.
I want us to renew our commitment to the residents of Boston around housing and climate change, public transit, improving our schools, addressing police reform in our city. Part of this agenda for renewing also means not only to bring people in left out of power, that we also create space for joy, what I've been calling a joy agenda.
So, Renee, I'm going to come back to you because there are echoes of so many things there. She has talked about an equity focus, her past experience. We hear a set of issues that are relevant to people of color in Boston. It also echoes Janae Osterholt, also of the Boston Globe, and Black Joy. So how do you see a joy agenda? And then I'm going to ask you what a joy agenda would look like, too, Renee.
I'm not entirely sure what a joy agenda looks like. I've always thankfully been able to access joy. But I think there's always an importance in realizing that being Black isn't simply about trauma, and that there are things to celebrate about Blackness, and there are ways to embrace that outside of all of the issues that we face. And I think that's very important that she's saying that. And I think it's important that people have been raising the idea, which, especially in this past year, where there's been so much heartache and so much death and so much upheaval, that there are ways to still celebrate life and celebrate Blackness. So I think it was important that she did talk about that. I think what's important with what we're seeing is, you know, people don't talk enough about lived experience with the people who lead us. And Kim Janey has the Boston experience, very much the Black Boston experience, whether you're talking about busing, you're talking about issues with housing, of being a single mom. There are all these issues that she has lived. And I think that gives her a very different sensitivity to the work that has to be done.
Ed, I'll turn to you in a minute, but listening to Renee, there's a little more sound. This is just fun. This is WBZ TV Channel 4 reporter Julie McDonald, who spoke with two young women of color at a playground in Janey's neighborhood about what Janey's ascension to the mayor's office means to them.
Well, I found out in my class, and I mean, it made me feel kind of excited and happy.
Mostly been white men than Black men.
All white men.
Yeah, and this is the first Black girl to do it.
How exciting is that?
It's the first Black person and the first girl, which is two things that are exciting.
I hear that. I just want to hug them both. It's just, you want to talk about a joy agenda. Just hearing these kids' voices, I think, is joyful. Ed, what else is a joy agenda for Boston? And hey, if you want to widen the aperture to a joy agenda for the Commonwealth, I'm all in. We could all use some joy.
Well, I do think there are things that are the same for the city and the state. I think there's been so much, you know, sadness and depression and angst about the pandemic. I think that, you know, Boston has a spirit to it that guides it. I think that if more people can feel good about Boston, they can cooperate on civic projects together. I think a lot of people need to get out of their comfort zone in order to achieve more equality and more shared prosperity. And they're only going to be able to get out of their comfort zone if they're feeling pretty good about things. I think if they're not feeling good, people are going to say, oh, someone else can try that, can reach out, can do that to make this little sacrifice for the greater good. I don't think we can get the kind of community building and justice if people don't feel good about the city as a living thing. So I like the idea of a joy agenda. People really do want to feel good after feeling so bad. And if Mayor Janey can get a lot of people feeling good, they're more likely to engage in the kind of civic activity that will produce more justice, which is what she wants.
Listeners, what's on your joy agenda for Boston? 800-423-8255. Meanwhile, we've got Dave on the line in West Roxbury. Dave, go ahead.
Well, first of all, she's my mayor now, and I wish her well, and I hope she does great. And I think if she put it the joy of getting the schools open fully, additionally having some sort of great summer program, and more importantly, something for the fall, she would get my vote if she decided to run for, I don't know, do you call it re-election or election this time? I don't even know what the proper term for that is.
That's a great question, Dave. I'm pretty sure it's election this time and lots to unpack there. I want to start with Dave's point about schools. She's been very clear, Kim Janey has, that education is core to her. Getting kids back in school is important to her. So this is where the rubber meets the road. Renee Graham, what early steps do you expect to see? She's got 9 months as acting mayor, hasn't said whether she's going to run yet or not. What early steps do you expect to see on a policy level?
I mean, I think schools really has to be at the top of her agenda. You know, we're a year into this pandemic, and there's just a sense that kids have been out of school much, much too long. However, there is a commitment, and there has to be a commitment, to getting teachers vaccinated, because teachers have to feel safe in going back into the classrooms. So I think that, you know, what's really interesting is, you know, she's becoming mayor at probably one of the most crucial moments in the city's recent history. I mean, there's really nothing comparable to this. And so I think that she's very much focused on that, because she's talked about that before she was sworn in. So I think her major focus, and she knows that there are a lot of voters who are thinking about it as well, a lot of parents, that, you know, schools have to be the priority. That, you know, the kids cannot go the rest of this semester without being in a classroom. And so, you know, we'll see. And I think a lot of that's going to continue to be around the vaccine rollout and teachers getting vaccinated.
You know, Ed, one of the things that strikes me is that as acting mayor, Kim Janey inherits really Marty Walsh's team. And so how much can she pursue an agenda that's on a different track from what Mayor Walsh had established? I don't know if you want to say in 7 years, because obviously there's turnover among the staff in any administration. But how does that factor in?
Well, there are plenty of good people in the Walsh administration. I mean, didn't Mayor Walsh appoint, Ms. Crockett to the chief of equity of the administration? There are plenty of people who are working for equity inside the administration. This is not hostile territory for her. It's a question of figuring out what will she do differently than Mayor Walsh, who also spoke about equity, who spoke about inequality, who spoke about the achievement gap and all of those things. What will she do differently than what Mayor Walsh had done? I mean, I can't believe the kids are still not in school. It is outrageous. Private schools and Catholic schools in Boston have been there in person for the whole year without vaccination. I mean, how can she talk about her school in Charlestown? Her school in Charlestown is closed. I mean, my goodness, if I was the mayor, I'd say you have 7 days to open. And if you can't do it, I'll find different people to do that. I mean, how can the schools possibly close for another month because of all the bureaucratic excuses? If you care about the achievement gap is getting worse every month. The kids are not in school. If she cares about the achievement gap, as she says, open the schools.
So the city of Boston has, and we'll talk more about this later in the show, the city of Boston has received a waiver. It will be reopening schools to full in-time learning, but it has received a waiver till the end of April. I also want to notice, and we're going to use this to transition in these last couple minutes before our break, to the Boston mayoral race. Actually, Boston Equity Chief Carolyn Crockett resigned earlier this month, and the thought was she might run for mayor, although she has since said that she won't. But there is a race here, and we don't know if Janey's running in it, Renee Graham, although your colleague, Boston Globe columnist Adrian Walker, this week wrote, quote, "Of course Janey is running," end quote.
He's right.
She told
of
us
course.
Yesterday. Yeah. All right. So why wouldn't she run, Renee?
I can't fathom a reason why she wouldn't run. I mean, I don't think being acting mayor is not going to be enough. She's going to want to win an election. She's going to want to have that support of Boston residents. And the only way to do that is to run. So I absolutely think she's going to run. I can also say that I'm very much buoyed by the diversity of the candidates. You know, that speaks very strongly to the direction Boston is attempting to move in, and that people feel that they have a different stake in this city than they had 10 years ago. You know, I think you mentioned it, or Ed might have mentioned that, you know, it was only in 2010 when Ayanna Pressley became the first Black woman on the city council. That was 2010, which is really appalling if you think about it. And here we are 11 years later, and there's a Black acting mayor, and you've got, you know, everyone from Andrea Campbell to Michelle Wu to John Santiago, you've got all of these very different people looking to put to make their mark on Boston. And I have no doubt that Kim Janey is going to be one of those people.
Hearing you say that, Renee, made me think of a comment that Tito Jackson made to us on air earlier this week about the changes in the last 10 years as well. Here he is.
For me, I have a Black woman mayor, Kim Janey. I have a Black woman congresswoman, sorry. I have a Black woman DA, Rachel Rollins. It is a wonderful day in my neighborhood.
And so Ed Lyons, then, Renee is pointing out the diversity of the candidate pool in the mayor's race as well. I'm struggling how to frame this question, but it seems it would be great for the city to have a very lively race with all these candidates and Kim Janey in the mix. Do we get a lively mayoral race if the acting mayor runs, or does she become kind of a Tom Menino juggernaut, given that he was acting mayor when he ran for his first mayoral election?
Well, I think we get a very lively race if we actually had a Republican running for office, but we're not going to get that, unfortunately. But I do think it can be as lively as the candidates will make it. I think Boston has a city with many successes and failures. It's up to the candidates to make it lively. I think there's plenty. We have very good media here in Greater Boston. I think it's up to them to make a case for what matters, to get the attention of the public. And getting attention of the public and getting people behind you is part of the job of being mayor. So I look forward to them making it lively. If they have different experiences, that's wonderful. They should be able to bring different perspectives and different issues to the table to get that attention.
Still with us, Ed Lyons, a Massachusetts Republican activist, and Renee Graham of the Boston Globe. We are doing really the Boston mayoralty in review this week for much of the show. Listeners, we talked about Kim Janey before the break. Now we're going to talk about Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. Well, now U.S. Labor Secretary Marty Walsh. How would you rate Marty Walsh's 7 years as mayor of the city of Boston? What are you thinking about from Walsh's legacy? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Actually, Ed, I'll start with you. Are we failing to sufficiently note the ascendancy of a Boston mayor to a United States cabinet position because there's been this other incredible moment of history happening in Boston this week?
No, we've been sort of talking about Mayor Walsh leaving for, it seems like, 6 months now. I think I've been contemplating his legacy in the media for about 8 weeks, but I'm getting better at it. So no, we haven't failed to notice. I think there's a lot going on, the pandemic. I think Mayor Janey is very exciting. I think he's gotten plenty of attention. He's gotten plenty of national attention for what he's doing. I don't think we're missing it. I think it's a lot to contemplate his 7 years, what was good, what was bad. How should we frame the past 7 years in terms of, you know, getting back on our feet, or do we get back on our feet? And does Kim Janey lead us somewhere else? So I do think we should talk about his legacy and whether or not we return to what he was working on, or whether or not Mayor Janey does different things.
So, Renee, in that... Well, I was going to go a different direction, but what Ed just said distracted me. It's like squirrel. So I'm going to head down the path Ed is giving us instead. What are some of the different things you want to see? What is something that was either unfinished or unsatisfying or without a negative lens, just needs more work from the Walsh administration that you'd really like to see Janey pick up on in the next 9 months, let's say?
You know, something Mayor Walsh talked about after George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis was creating a police force that was more transparent and more accountable in Boston. And he did this to great fanfare. And then that nothing really happened. And I use the example of something that my colleague Marcela Garcia wrote about a few days ago, in that it was reported that there was a Boston police officer who participated in the deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. And there was supposed to be a report about the investigation, about a social media post, and then nothing kind of happened. We heard no more about it. And that kind of flew in the face of all of Mayor Walsh's talk about transparency and accountability. And I feel very much the same way about everything that's happening. People forget that Boston right now still doesn't have a permanent police commissioner. Dennis White was put on leave after accusations of domestic violence. I mean, decades old accusations, but accusations nonetheless. And then we were supposed to hear about what happened with that. And the mayor actually pushed back against releasing any files on Dennis White. So again, I really would like to see Mayor Janey take up that mantle that Mayor Walsh ultimately seems he had no stomach for. He talked about it, but that's all he did.
Ed, what Renee's saying is really resonating. It happens that the last time we talked with Mayor Walsh on Mondays with the Mayor, here on Radio Boston was right after. So that was a Monday. And over the weekend, the police body camera footage had been released from the summer protests. And it was a tense conversation with him because it was a tense subject. He stopped coming on after that because just after that he was nominated, he stopped doing these kinds of interviews. But even with that fresh in my mind, it does seem like policing is kind of his biggest hanging chad, if you want to use a 2000 reference, or unfinished piece of business, Ed.
Yeah, I mean, I think he completely failed on police reform. I mean, he talked a good game, but ultimately the preferences of the police were what guided what actually happened, as Renee said. He was never going to reform the police in any meaningful way. I don't like saying that because he clearly wanted something to happen, but, you know, it just didn't. I think also that, I think the housing prices, I mean, he made us a leader in affordable housing, but it still wasn't good enough. I think the rents are still way too high. I think there's not enough prosperity in certain parts of the city. I think he kind of failed to make the innovation district happen in, you know, what is now Nubian Square. I'd like to see her figure out how to get more prosperity happening in the black and brown neighborhoods. I'd like to see changes in licensing and permitting. I'd like to see some real experiments in generating economic activity. I think people would go with pretty much anything that would help the economy get going in Boston. I'd love to see her get a whole bunch of new advisors with different ideas about how to get more activity going, especially in black and brown neighborhoods.
So let's look ahead, listeners, now, as we're talking about Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, who has now become the U.S. Secretary of Labor. What does that mean for the Commonwealth? What do you want to come home to Massachusetts with a cabinet member in the Biden administration, especially things having to do with labor? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Renee, does it mean anything special for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to have Marty Walsh in the Biden administration?
Well, I think the Commonwealth would like to think so. I don't think that Walsh is, you know, going to D.C. and is going to suddenly forget where he came from, or the needs of the city and the way he can serve them in a very different way. Hopefully he understands that there was unfinished work here in terms of income inequality and issues like that, issues that were very much exacerbated during the pandemic. So, Boston has expectations, you know, that's the way it is. He's been mayor here for 7 years, and their expectations are that when he goes to Washington as labor secretary, that he's going to remember the needs of this city and of this state and some of the work that needs to be done here.
So, Ed, I'm mindful of the fact that, as we said at the top, first person with a deep union background in that role since the 1970s. At the same time, between when Joe Biden announced his nomination and when this vote came from the Senate, some things happened. For example, some construction site deaths, and he will be overseeing OSHA. And this was a city where OSHA violations led to some construction site deaths. What is the complexity, of his legacy and his role in Washington? And what do you expect to see?
I'm just hoping that he puts in the work. I think that, you know, the national dialogue about labor is very limited. It's about unionization. It's about the minimum wage. And that's pretty much it. You know, what are the employment numbers? There's a lot of things that matter to the working people. I think workplace safety and conditions is a great issue. Plenty of workers have terrible working conditions where they have chemicals their bodies are absorbing that are bad for them. I think there's a lot of labor issues. I think he can do the most amount of good by looking for opportunities to make these changes in the lives of workers that are not what's in the front page, but will actually help the lives of many workers across the country. So I'm hoping he just puts in the work, finds some new issues, makes progress on these issues at the federal level. I think that could be a great legacy because he is sort of a guy from the neighborhoods, as he was known in Boston. I just think that hopefully his on the ground sense of things will help him say, you know, rather than just go to press conferences and make pronouncements, you know, what could the federal government do that would actually make a difference in the day-to-day lives of workers at their jobs? And the OSHA stuff is a good example of the kind of difficult work to be done, making people's working conditions better, which becomes a healthcare issue and many other issues if it's not addressed properly.
Renee, one of the things that's interesting about a sustained daily conversation here on Radio Boston about the issues of the city and the issues of the state is you start to hear patterns emerge. And in the last 6 months, I've heard so much more talk about unions than maybe in the 6 to 12 months before that. The importance of unions, the safety dimensions that unions bring to the table, even conversations about the power of certain unions versus other unions in the scramble, for example, to get in line and for vaccinations. Are we having a new union moment?
I certainly hope so. You know, I think as Ed mentioned, it's not a coincidence that Joe Biden, who's always pushed himself as a union guy, gets Marty Walsh to be his labor secretary. You know, there's a moment in this country, and maybe it might not have happened if not for the pandemic. I think what the last year has reminded people is just how important it is as a worker to be protected. And a lot of people don't have that. So, you know, I would love nothing more than, you know, a kind of union revival in this country. You know, unions made this country great. And I think it's really important that people respect what unions do and more so what workers do. So I'm hoping that is something that Walsh can do and also just extend his influence in looking at things like childcare, which is a workplace issue. All of these kinds of things, you know, he can remake, you know, that cabinet position into what it needs to be. And I think its demands are much greater now than they would have been a year ago.
So, Ed, in a couple minutes, we're going to go to a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about a bunch of pandemic stuff. So as we get ready to do that, last question to you on this legacy of Marty Walsh. Where do you grade him on his handling of the pandemic?
Oh, geez, I don't know, maybe like an A-. I think he's done very well. You know, now that we're after a year of this, I think we no longer have fantasies about how it all could have gone well, looking at other states and other cities and all of that. I think Boston got hit hard early. We didn't sort of have months and months to prepare for it the way that other cities in the country did because they weren't affected as early. They didn't know, they wouldn't have known any more than we did about it when it started. So I think he did very well. I really can't look back and think, well, he should have done this or done that. So I think his legacy is on the pandemic, I think is pretty good.
So let's grab one listener call before we go to the break, 800-423-8255, to review the whole week with us. We've got Scott on the line in Manchester. Scott, go ahead.
Hi. I have, in retrospect, a reflection on the accomplishments of Mayor Walsh. And that's the aftermath of the Big Dig and the development of Massport at Logan Airport. You know, as you look at that over years, it's been prohibitively expensive to park at Logan Airport, and the parking availability is under capacity, obviously not now, but in the future. So, you know, regardless of whether you're a labor secretary or anybody, I would hope that there's some sort of reengineering of that economic model that he can bring back home to the state of Massachusetts and locally to Massport. And I think you've probably seen how, you know, one day is $120 to park at Logan Airport. I mean, come on, seriously. So that's my comment. I'll take it offline.
Thanks for that, Scott. Actually, it's been so long since I've gone to Logan Airport because of the pandemic. I don't know what parking for a day is there. But that's Scott reminding us that at the end of the day, what we want from our officials is the practical stuff. So thanks for that. So listen, one of our, the economy lot, by the way, is $26 a day, according to our producer, Jamie Bologna. Jamie, thanks for that. Boston Globe columnist Renee Graham and Republican political writer Ed Lyons. You know, we take our eyes off the pandemic ball for 2 seconds to pay attention to some mayoral history, and here we go again. So listeners, for the rest of the show, we are going to talk about the pandemic and where we are in the Commonwealth. Cases are ticking up. The state is reopening more. As more people are vaccinated, we have questions about supply. Are we getting more? Are we getting less? Is it going to stay flat? Is it going to ramp up? And what about now that it's warm? Are you changing your behavior? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So Renee, Ed, I want to start with where we are. 32 cities and towns are now high risk. That's up from 12. Excuse me. That is up 12 from last week. Cases, they're trending upwards, have for the last 2 weeks, as is the positivity rate. The Cape has a positivity rate that's twice that of the rest of the state. Ed, how are you feeling? Are we, about the pandemic, are we trending for a fourth surge here?
I think we're in a we're in a race with the fourth surge. I think this fourth surge is already here. It's spreading quickly among young people, but not amongst the very old because they've been vaccinated. And I feel like that we are in this race, but I think we have to just keep trying to vaccinate. We're doing pretty well according to the data, but we have to keep doing well because the public is not going to deal with being locked down more. The public, I was out today, cars, people everywhere. It's been that way for a while. The public more or less decided to reopen themselves a couple of months ago. So I think that Governor Baker is trying to wrestle with the fact that people are kind of done with the restrictions as far as I can see out there.
That's really striking. The public have essentially decided to reopen themselves. Another thing you said, Ed, resonates, and I want to turn to you on this, Renee, which is the surge in cases among young people and how we're talking about that, thinking about that as a community. Yesterday at his regular press conference about vaccinations and the pandemic, Governor Baker chided young people for the uptick in cases. Here he is.
We're now seeing more positive cases for people under the age of 30. While these residents are far less likely to be hospitalized, it remains critically important for all residents, and especially young people, to continue to practice prevention strategies and not let down their guard.
Renee, I know young people who are worried they are going to get blamed for this pandemic for a generation. Are we being too hard on our young people? Are we focusing in the right way? Are we making the right public policy decisions when it comes to our young people? What do you think?
I mean, I don't know. Who doesn't like to be chided by the governor? you know, I think it's a complicated thing. And I think Ed made a very interesting comment when he said that people just decide to reopen themselves. And that's really what we're seeing. And I don't think it's just young people. Yes, the numbers are going up among younger residents because they're not getting vaccinated the way older people are. So they're less protected. But that doesn't mean everyone needs to take their eye off the ball. What it kind of feels like is when I actually used to get downtown, and there'd be that moment where people were all sort of stacked up at the sidewalk getting ready to cross the street, and they would decide they were just tired of waiting for the light to change and would just start to walk, feeling like, well, it'll all work out. That's how it feels a little bit. Like people are thinking, well, it's all going to work out. People are getting vaccinated. I think there is just the most extraordinary kind of pandemic fatigue that's sort of overtaking a lot of people who feel like, well, it's going to be okay because there's a vaccine. But, you know, I agree with Ed. We're in this race against the fourth surge, and some experts have been talking about a fourth surge for months. I think that's exactly what we're seeing, and we have to see how it's going to play out, you know, while people are still being vaccinated. But I don't know that kind of like leaning on people under the age of 30 is helpful. Yeah, everybody needs to be stepping up. You need to be socially distancing. You need to be wearing masks. But how do you tell people that when you're opening restaurants and saying, go do this and you can go to a hockey game? You can't, those two measures don't quite work. Either you're going to tell people to take serious measures, because once people are out, I think they start to get really slack about what the rules are and about keeping masks on, about social distancing, because it's been really long and people are very tired, but we're talking about lives at stake here.
Look what happened in Germany. You know, in Germany, where Angela Merkel had to get on television and apologize for ordering a lockdown. The people are done with that in Germany, and they're in much, much worse shape than us. I mean, people are just not going to keep doing this.
Listeners, have you reopened for yourselves? Do you agree with Ed and Renee in your assessment that that's kind of where we are, especially as the weather is warmer? And what are the next steps we take if that's the case? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I also want to note we are seeing hospitalizations go down. We are seeing infection rates go down among our older populations. We still know that the majority of deaths are happening in our older populations here in the Commonwealth. We're also vaccinating our older populations. And people under 30 can't get vaccinated yet. And with our supply where it stands and the pace at which we're doing it, won't for quite a while. I think that's worth flagging as we talk about the tensions here. There's another thing I want to pick up on that, Renee, you were talking about mixed messages, and I want to hone in on that for a second. So I'm going to start with the fact that Cape Cod has a double the positivity rate of the state. Here is State Senator Julian Sears speaking with WBUR from the Cape. Here he is.
It's very incumbent for all of us on Cape Cod to get this outbreak under control and fast. So we're relying on our residents to continue to follow the well-worn COVID-19 mitigation strategies.
So we also did a travel call in this week, and in it we noted that the Boston Herald reporting that, you know, Cape reservations for the summer are through the roof. They're filling up. So we have this, again, this tension between the realities of what the virus is doing and the reality of what people are doing. And I'm not sure what we do policy-wise to put one foot in front of the other in that tension, Ed.
No, I mean, people know what it is. They know about distancing and masking and not getting crowds indoors. They know it all. This is not an awareness education thing. We don't have messaging to get them. People are deliberately saying, I'm just done with that. Oh, my parents got vaccinated. Oh, there was a huge party in Swampscott in Governor Baker's own town. I mean, if Baker can't get his own neighbors to follow the rules, well, what's going to happen? I just think, I mean, I'm not blaming the governor for this. I just think that people know what they're supposed to do, and they've just said, I just can't do it, or I won't do it, or there's no point anymore, or the old people have been vaccinated. The weather is wonderful. Let's go see people. I just think we have to manage where the public is really at. I don't think closing the restaurants is going to have anything to do with what people are doing.
Actually, I'm going to go to the phones here, 800-423-8255. We've got Helen Marie on the line from Shrewsbury. Helen Marie, go ahead.
Hi. Been listening to the call today, and just wanted to say that for people who feel like they want to, quote, open up for themselves, I feel like it's a selfish stance. I feel like we need to be for the good of the whole, the good of the community, and the good of our medical care workers, and that our small sacrifice of distancing, wearing masks, keeping our hands clean is small compared to the sacrifice of our healthcare providers.
Helen Marie, thank you for that call. Renee, Helen Marie is calling us back to solidarity. And this is something in the year that we've all reflected on this together. And we've, here at Radio Boston, we've reflected with both of you a number of times. We've come in and out of this sense of solidarity and the call to it. How do we renew the call to solidarity with each other in a compelling way right now?
Well, I'm not sure we ever fully embraced the call to solidarity. And I've said this before, I think one of the greater mistakes made early on was saying to people that wearing the mask will protect others. I just don't think we're really good at that. I think people should have been told wearing the mask will protect you. I think people don't really care enough about each other. We've seen that for the last year.
No, I don't want to hear that.
I'm sorry. I just, you know, when people have this sense like, well, you know, if I get it, I get it. That's great. But you're not thinking about the person you might give it to, you know, and there's been so much of that, and that hasn't changed. Look what we've seen in Miami and Miami Beach in the last week and what's been going on down there. It's like there's just this sense that, yes, there's a fatigue, people are tired of it, but in the final analysis, people simply don't care. They want to do what they want to do. American individualism is killing us. That is a lot of what has happened in the last year, and people don't see the need to stop that now.
All right, Ed, we just heard Renee say American individualism is killing us. Let me just give you a chance to respond or react or build or whatever you want to do with that.
Well, I think other countries are seeing this too. I think the history of disease shows that people can't maintain these sorts of procedures forever. At some point, people just become fatalistic and say, well, the heck with it. I have to live my life. And that is not new. It is not American. Again, as I said earlier, that people in Germany are tired of the lockdowns. They certainly don't have American individualism there. And they've given up on this, apparently, in terms of the restrictions. Yeah. And they have it much worse than we do. I think it's a human thing. It's a community thing. I think Renee's right. I'm not sure that we care enough about each other. And I think preventing a virus and spreading is not something we've sort of evolved to do, to think in such an abstract way that I don't want to spread the disease to some other young person who may give it to their aunt who's not vaccinated. I just don't think it's a natural impulse for us. So I think that's very hard to maintain that consensus for 14 months. I just don't think it's possible. We have to just accept it and figure out what we can do to mitigate it. I don't think we're going to go back to where we were 11 months ago when we were scared enough to follow the instructions.
I want to go to the phones here. We've got some callers who want to build on things the two of you have said. 800-423-8255. First, let's go to Elizabeth in Cambridge. Elizabeth, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say I completely agree with Renee. There is definitely mixed messaging coming from the governor. He is complaining about the 30 under 30 crowd, and I'm not an under 30 crowd, might I add, and then opening up restaurants and forcing schools to reopen. That's sending the wrong message. Either we stay in conservative, keeping your masks on, keeping social distancing, not eating in restaurants, or we open up and vaccinate people who are under 30.
Thanks for that, Elizabeth. Let's add another voice, Ashley in Salem. Go ahead, Ashley.
Yeah, thank you so much for this really fascinating conversation, because I think you're getting at the root of some of the confusion right now. As someone who is very close to my parents, and my parents have a very close relationship with my child who's 3 years old, there is this message given to grandparents, you can see your grandchildren again. And yet my child, who's three and has a history of some pulmonary issues, he's not going to get vaccinated anytime soon. And it's wonderful that my parents are vaccinated. I'm so grateful for that. And I'm almost fully vaccinated. But I just think there is such mixed messaging happening from the CDC also. And where do all of those people fall in trying to honor, yes, let's get vaccinated because your life will start to open, but not yet. We're just not there yet. And how do we keep it going? How do we keep this movement going of let's continue to get vaccinated, but still maintain our safety measures, our security measures?
Ashley, thanks for that call. So Renee, listening to Ashley makes me think of the calls we got yesterday. So we did a travel segment. We had Dr. Natasha Hochberg as a medical expert. We had your colleague, Christopher Muther, travel writer at the Boston Globe. And one of the things, we got so many calls from families where the grandparents are vaccinated, the rest of the family are not, and true confusion about what can we do, what can't we do, who do I say yes to, you know, can the grandparents come, can they come in their car, can they, what about our challenges with consistent safety messaging?
Well, you know, it's tough because like last night on the evening news, not the national news, their last segment was about grandparents seeing their grandchildren again. And of course it was heartwarming. And it was like, you know, everyone's bursting into tears and hugging and doing things. But what are we saying? It's not over. I keep thinking back to, like, you know, the peak of the AIDS crisis, when we saw there was finally a cocktail that people could take to keep themselves alive. And there was a sense like, oh, everything's great. But there were all these people saying it's not over. And that's where we are. This is not over. And, you know, we're really on the precipice of slipping again. When you're talking about places like Germany at one time was a model for what the rest of the world could do. Now they're having a lot of problems. We were never the model. We were the model for what not to do. So, you know, the fact that the cases are going back up, but we're sort of promoting this idea that you can get together with other people who've been vaccinated and you can do this and you'll be able to do that. It feels like it's just too soon. You know, again, it would be different, but I was talking about there's still 1,000 deaths a day in this country. It's too much. It's not time. There's got to be more consistent messaging, because all it's doing is confusing people and putting them at risk.
800-423-8255 is the number to call. Let's go to Noreen in Newton. Noreen, go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I would like to say I completely agree with Renee. I feel the message from the governor is that we can take our masks off because we can resume our activities, especially in restaurants. And I think we need the moral leadership to stay in lockdown. I see it myself. We need the moral leadership. People think the governor thinks it's okay, then I think it's okay for me, when it's not. Our numbers are going up. I think the governor is actually, his steps are going to lead to more deaths and more cases, and we have the long haulers. And it's a myth that the children don't get really sick, because they do, and we all know it. We know cases. I know people myself. I've had deaths of friends and family members. And I am really sick of this mixed message, and I would like the governor, as I said, to have some moral leadership for the rest of us. And I thank you for discussing
this. Thanks, Noreen. I do want to clarify, just because of some of the things Noreen said there, that we do know that hospitalization and death are significantly higher for people in the older age brackets than for kids. We also know that 0 to 19 is the highest new infection rates in the Commonwealth. I just want to be clear about what the data is telling us. We're going to go to Hubbubs in a minute. Ed, I want to give you a chance to respond to Noreen there and share any other thoughts for just a minute before we go to our Hubbubs.
Noreen, I wish it was true. You know, I wish there was a way the government could just get everyone could do the right thing, or the medical community. But I see people in my life for many years making bad decisions themselves and others my whole life. And I think the idea that we can just create this religion that will go on forever, that everybody does the right thing forever in everybody's minds. I mean, yes, it's been a year. I mean, I'm so grateful we were so compliant for so long, that we've so many people did the right thing for so long. I mean, I just don't think it's possible for everyone to be constantly thinking of these things while suffering so badly from the consequences of the lockdowns. I just think humanity is a messy business, and government can't just make everyone do the right thing all the time. Otherwise, they would have them do the right thing with their own physical health and what they ate and smoking and drinking and all kinds of other things and violence and personal habits. I just think humanity is messy, and I'm proud of what we accomplished, even though I'm disappointed the fact that we just can't do it long enough.
All right. Well, I am going to turn us to our hubbubs, but we've left a lot of callers on the line. And Renee and Ed, I want to tell you, your framings of this conversation really resonated with our listeners today. So thank you for that. I do want to go to our hubbubs because those are those local stories or event that caught our attention this week. They're always just a great way to head into the weekend. Renee, what do you have?
After all my pessimism, less than 200 days until the Boston Marathon.
The Boston Marathon.
October 11th. I'm not saying I'm going to run. I might not even go. But just the idea that a piece of Boston, this very integral piece of the city, can be back gives me something to look forward to.
Oh, I love you for bringing that up, Renee. That gives me some joy, too. Ed, what do you have for a hubbub?
Well, just today, our former governor, Mitt Romney, now a senator from Utah, was awarded the Profiles in Courage Award from the local JFK Institute for his vote to impeach Donald Trump. And I think that's really interesting. I mean, if those of us were old enough to remember that Romney actually ran against Ted Kennedy for Senate a million years ago, I think it might've been 94, remember that race. And the idea that the Kennedy Institute would be giving Mitt Romney award for conscience is quite a thing that happened today. And I was really amused to see it.
So Ed, actually, because you told us you were going to bring us that hubbub, we have a clip of Senator Romney on NBC's Today Show today talking about that vote in 2020 to impeach President Donald J. Trump. Here he is.
No question, there are a few people that are not happy with me, and I understand that that's the nature of the job that I've got. I sleep well because I know that I did what my conscience told me was the right thing to do.
And I enjoyed the tinge of irony that you brought to that, too, Ed. Thank you so much. All right, so I'm going to give you mine now. So it was a tweet by Margot Bloomstein on Wednesday, and it said, quote, "This just went up around the corner, and I have so many questions," end quote. So with the tweet was a picture of a for sale sign in front of a house west of Boston. There was an extra piece of signage that said, "Not haunted," on it. So according to Stephen Neer, the Boston Globe, that took off. You get stars like George Takei and Neil Gaiman retweeting. I just want to say I do not have questions. If you feel the need to tell me that a house is not haunted, I'm going to go ahead and assume that it's haunted. I'm also going to go ahead and assume that in this market, it's going to sell fast and above asking anyway.
No, but there still has to be home inspection, right?
That's right. That's right. All right. That is our show for this week. Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And Renee Graham, Boston Globe columnist and WBUR contributor. Great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, listeners, thank you, too. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Walter Wuthman, with help from Stephen Gelman. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal, our executive producer, Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for calling. Thanks for listening. Thanks for living, too. Have a great week and join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.